listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Happy hump day. We are only halfway through the week, but we have tons to talk about. Civility is going down the tubes. The Supreme Court released three major decisions and also announced some big news. And then I have a conversation with Bill Shillier, who is running for Iowa House. But before we get to all that, first a word from one of our sponsors, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Democrat who represents California's 43rd Congressional District, encouraged supporters during a rally on Sunday to harass members of the Trump administration.
Already, you have members of your cabinet that have been booed out of restaurants. Who have protesters taking up at their house. Who sang no peace, no sleep. No peace, no sleep. And guess what? We're going to win this battle because while you try and quote the Bible, Jeff Sessions and others, you really don't know the Bible. God is on our side. On the side of the children. On the side of what's right. On the side of what's honorable. On the side of understanding that if we can't protect the children, we can't protect anybody. And so, let's stay the course. Let's make sure we show up wherever we have to show up. And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere. We've got to get the children connected to their parents. The children are...
Well, that's just wonderful. One problem, however, President Trump already signed an executive order saying that families will no longer be separated at the border, so I'm not entirely sure what they're protesting. This follows Secretary of Homeland Security Christian Nielsen being harassed and chased out of a D.C. area Mexican restaurant. Protesters have also been outside her home. ABC News Radio reports that there have been increasing threats to Department of Homeland Security employees. Quote, Department of Homeland Security employees are seeing violent threats with greater frequency because of the president's immigration policy, according to an official with knowledge of recent threat assessment. The department determined that there was a heightened threat against DHS employees in response to recent government actions surrounding immigration, according to a letter sent to employees over the weekend, unquote. ABC News Radio also reported that, according to an official with knowledge of the incident, a DHS official living in Washington, D.C. area found a burnt and decapitated animal on his front porch. I'm going to go out on a limb and say whoever did that probably wasn't with PETA. Also, this follows Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi being accosted when she left a movie. Then Trump Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders also confirmed that she was asked to leave the Red Hen, a restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, over the weekend when she was eating dinner with her family. The owner, who was apparently was called in by employees working there, took a vote among her staff and asked her to leave, citing that she did not want to force her Hispanic or LGBT employees from having to serve Sanders due to recent decisions made by the Trump administration, as well as what she says was dishonesty by the Trump administration. The owner has a right to ask her to leave. Sanders had the right to tweet about it. Trump supporters have the right to boycott if they so choose. I'm far less concerned about all of this than I am instances of protesters harassing Trump administration officials. this has the potential to become violent. David French with National Review in a piece on Monday asked, where is the line with these protests? He writes, quote, angry, in-your-face confrontations dramatically increase the chances of violence. Put people in close proximity, yelling and spitting, and public officials will rightly start to fear that they're in physical danger. While millions of Americans don't remember that a Bernie Sanders supporter last year tried to assassinate a significant portion of the GOP Congress, you can be assured that not a single Republican in Washington has forgotten. They can never be sure that the screaming person in front of them doesn't mean them physical harm. Argue against these dangerous confrontations, and you'll always get the same response. The administration is uniquely evil. It was taking children from their parents. The president just tweeted that he wants to strip due process rights from illegal immigrants. Desperate times call for desperate measures. What is the limiting principle here? He asked, unquote. What is the limiting principle? That's a good question. How many issues will the desperate, will, quote, desperate times call for desperate measures, unquote, rationale be applied to? Political scientist Thomas Schaller was quoted in a Bloomberg Politics op-ed saying, quote, I think we're at the beginning of a soft civil war. I don't know if the country gets out of it whole, unquote. Then Francis Wilkinson, author of that opinion piece, writes, quote, I don't know exactly what that would look like, but liberals have a great deal of cultural, academic, and economic heft stretching from Hollywood to Harvard. Just this week, some Hollywood powerhouses flirted with leveraging their clout against a Trumpist Fox News. There are endless variations on such a power play. If Democrats opt to use their power more aggressively, breaking rules, Schaller's soft civil war hardly seems unlikely, unquote. And that is a frightening proposal or prospect. There is a temptation to want to respond in kind, but those of us who follow Christ understand that's not an option. We are to be civil to those who oppose us, and that's just the bare minimum. We are called to love our enemies. We can't go down this road. David French, in the same piece I referred to earlier, points out that this tactic typically backfires politically. Quote, finally, if recent American history is any guide, the mob only sows the seeds of its own destruction. Americans don't like political violence. They're not impressed by men trying to physically intimidate women. They don't like to see protesters disturbing the peace of a person's home. The last time the left turned to rage, it lost presidential elections in landslides. If given the choice between terrible tweets and chaos in the streets, voters will choose the tweets every time. And I agree. Those who protest could very well drive Americans to Republicans. We'll have to wait and see in November whether this does backfire. Big news at the Supreme Court. Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy announced that he would retire effective July 31st. Kennedy, appointed by President Ronald Reagan, took the oath of office on February 18, 1988. He has been a swing vote on a number of big decisions. He typically deferred towards individual rights. He was a champion, consistently a champion for the First Amendment. But he was also the deciding vote in Obergefell v. Hodges that legalized marriage for same-sex couples nationwide in 2015. President Trump has said that he plans to nominate someone off the list he shared when he campaigned for president that the Federalist Society helped piece together, which was kind of a who's who of originalist judges and a very good list, in my opinion. Say what you will about President Trump, he has made some fabulous judicial picks. And the Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who replaced Antonin Scalia, has been a reliable originalist. This upcoming vacancy is a shift in the makeup of the court, and with the right pick, provided the Senate can confirm, and it appears they'll not wait until the midterm elections, you could have a reliable originalist majority block on the court. It probably doesn't shift it as much, say, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer retired, but it's still a shift nonetheless. Senate Judiciary Chair, our home U.S. Senator, Chuck Grassley, said, quote, I expect the president will soon nominate someone for the Senate to consider. I encourage the president to choose a nominee with the credentials, intellect, and commitment to the rule of law necessary to serve on the Supreme Court. I look forward to having the nominee before us in the Senate Judiciary Committee for his or her hearing in the weeks ahead, unquote. The Supreme Court released some important decisions this week. They upheld the First Amendment and ruled against California's forced speech law and the state's, which is the state's Reproductive Fact Act, that compelled California's licensed pro-life crisis pregnancy centers to advertise for state-subsidized abortions. Agencies that were unlicensed had to disclose that they were not licensed, as if their clients, you know, didn't know that they didn't provide medical services. Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote the majority opinion, which was 5-4, wrote, quote, "The license notice is a content-based regulation of speech. By compelling individuals to speak a particular message, such notices alter the content of their speech. By requiring petitioners to inform women how they obtain state-subsidized abortions at the same time petitioners try to dissuade women from choosing that option, the license notice plainly alters the content of petitioner's speech," unquote. Justice Kennedy, in a concurring opinion, stated, quote, "It does appear that viewpoint discrimination is inherent in the design and structure of this act. This law is a paradigmatic example of the serious threat presented when government seeks to impose its own message in the place of individual speech, thought, and expression. For here, the state requires primarily pro-life pregnancy centers to promote the state's own preferred message, advertising abortions. This compels individuals to contradict their most deeply held beliefs, beliefs grounded in basic philosophical, ethical, or religious precepts, or all of these," unquote. And then he continued, quote, "Governments must not be allowed to force persons to express a message contrary to their deepest convictions. Freedom of speech secures the freedom of thought and belief. This law imperils those liberties," unquote. The Supreme Court also ruled yet again that President Trump's travel ban was constitutional. Chief Justice John Roberts, in this 5-4 majority decision, wrote in the majority opinion that the Immigration Naturalization Act, quote, "grants the president broad discretion to suspend the entry of aliens into the United States. The president lawfully exercised that discretion based on his findings following a worldwide multi-agency review that entry of the covered aliens would be detrimental to the national interest, and plaintiff's attempts to identify a conflict with other provisions in the INA and their appeal to the statute's purposes and legislative history failed to overcome the clear statutory language," unquote. The state of Hawaii was the petitioner in this particular case, tried to cite President Trump's justification for the travel ban, which, by the way, is practically identical to past travel bans. Roberts addresses this, quote, "Moreover, plaintiff's request for searching injury into the persuasiveness of the president's justifications is inconsistent with the broad statutory text and the deference traditionally accorded to the president in this sphere," unquote. In a nutshell, President Trump lawfully exercised his Article II powers, executing the law that Congress has passed, and just as past presidents have done. This whole legal battle has been nonsensical. The Supreme Court also, in Janus v. AFSCME, says that states and public sector unions may no longer extract agency fees from non-consenting employees. Justice Samuel Alito wrote for the majority in this 5-4 decision, quote, "Free speech serves many ends. It is essential to our democratic form of government, and it furthers the search for truth. Whenever the federal government or state prevents individuals from saying what they think on important matters or compels them to voice ideas with which they disagree, it undermines these ends," unquote. Now, AFSCME would say that these agency fees did not apply toward the political activity, whether it's campaign funding or whether it's lobbying of the union. However, money is fungible. Any money that is collected for the purpose of collective bargaining for the entire bargaining unit, both union employees and non-union employees alike, any money not spent for that can go toward political activity. Samuel Alito addressed this. He said, quote, "The First Amendment does not permit the government to compel a person to pay for another party's speech just because the government thinks that speech furthers the interests of the person who does not want to pay," unquote. So in a nutshell, Justice Alito wrote in the syllabus of the decision, quote, "The First Amendment is violated when money is taken from non-consenting employees for a public sector union. Employees must choose to support the union before anything is taken from them. Accordingly, neither an agency fee nor any other form of payment to a public sector union may be deducted from an employee, nor may any other attempt be made to collect such a payment unless the employee affirmatively consents to pay." So some have remarked that the Janus, unquote, some have remarked that the Janus decision will end public sector employee unions, but no, it does no such thing. Unions are still allowed, and public employees are allowed to use them to join. Non-members are not required to pay any dues or agency fees without their consent. You know, perhaps it'll hurt the pocketbook, the union's pocketbook, but it does not end public sector employee unions. They may find less fungible money to spend on political campaigns and lobbying, but they are still free to recruit membership. Next, I speak with Bill Shillier, who is a Republican running against Senate Representative Ruth Ann Gaines in Iowa House District 32. But first, a word from a longtime sponsor, Travis Riswold from Modern Woodmen of America, who can help you with your life insurance needs.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Will, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your campaign.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So a question I always ask every candidate I interview, whether they're running for a county position or they're presidential candidate, is why are you running for office?
Why am I running? I am running because I've noticed at times when I wanted to contact my legislator, to talk about issues, she didn't line up with mine at all.
Okay.
And so we got to looking around on who could we put up to challenge her best, and that job fell to me, and I was happy to do it. We sit around and kind of armchair quarterback politics and complain, mm-hmm. but that's not going to get anything changed.
Right.
So I stepped up and decided to run.
For the sake of our listeners, just want to say that you're running in Iowa House District 32, and State Representative Ruth Ann Gaines is your representative.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So, what are some of the issues that don't line up with you?
Some of the big issues are, obviously she's voted against every possible bill that would protect the unborn. She voted against the 20-week ban. She voted against the heartbeat bill. She voted against keeping our tax dollars out of Planned Parenthood. And, the science has come out of very leftist universities over the last few years. And it's clear that these babies are feeling every bit of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way I'm going to sit down and be quiet about that. Gun rights is another big issue. You're not going to find anybody with a better rating on gun rights. She's got somehow a 21% rating by the NRA, and I really don't know how she scraped together a 21%. But I'm proud of my A rating. Anybody who knows me knows that the bill's gonna protect their Second Amendment rights for sure.
Maybe 21% is that she does it. She won't vote to repeal a gun right or something. Who knows?
I would guess it's got to be something along the lines of I straight up won't vote to repeal the Second Amendment. It would probably be how she got that together.
Right. Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I graduated a year early from high school and had absolutely no desire to go to college.
Okay.
And so I started some blue collar jobs. I joined the UFCW 1149 in Marshalltown, Iowa, worked at the packing house. Okay. And then I went over and worked for Rockwell Collins. I actually ended up being an inspector, or they call it an auditor there, at Rockwell Collins in the microelectronics department. And there I was a member of the IBEW 1634. So I know we've got a lot of people saying that Republicans want to cancel your right to unionize. And believe me, that's the exact opposite.
Okay.
I'm not sure why that became a partisan issue. I really haven't, you know,
if you work
for a company, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the pushback, at least recent pushback, has been due to the Republicans passing the collective bargaining law last year that impacted not private unions, but public employee unions.
In this state that really ramped it up. But there was certainly a lot of partisanship before that. And, you know, it seems kind of nonsensical. You know, the Teamsters backed Reagan in the 1980 election. So it's not a partisan thing. It's are you looking out for everybody who has a job, which, you know, in my district, we're all blue collar guys. Our median income is $39,000 a year. Mm-hmm. We all go to work hard every day, and we're tired of having 25% of our paycheck taken away and always under the threat of, hey, we're going to limit you from having this kind of gun or a magazine that holds this many bullets or any of this nonsense.
Right.
So we've got an option this time.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. You've got, you know, I think by all reasonable analysis, you've got a tough climb in Iowa House District 32. Looking at the most recent registration numbers that came out, there's about a 5,000 registered voter deficit, Democrat to Republican for you in your district. How do you plan to overcome that?
Well, here's what happened in 2016. I was nominated at the very end.
Okay.
And I ran out and I knocked over 2,000 doors myself. And I said, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm for. I've got no problem fighting the establishment. and you can ask some people within my party. I'll call a strike a strike.
Right.
And what I found was these are people just like me. These are people who go to work every day, like I said, scrape together an earning, and they want the government to leave them alone. And what I started to see was there was that big union influence. You know, Republicans are bad, Democrats are this and that. And what people saw was, for the first time, they voted Republican because of Trump. You know, Trump said, hey, these issues are happening. I'll stand up for you and I'll fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so this paradigm of voting straight Democrat has really gone away in my district. So in my district, there's roughly 2,600 Republicans. I think there was roughly 7,700 Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nearly 5,000 non-party.
Okay.
And that's a pretty good representation. A lot of us are just tired of the party, you know, Democrat or Republican. We're tired of whenever there's an issue, one leader in the party says, this is our stance, and everybody gets on their side of the line and starts throwing spitwads back and forth. And what we found was, in my short run in 2016, I pulled in 500 more votes than there even are Republicans in my district. My opponent brought in almost 800 votes less than there are Democrats in this district. So in my short little run, just knocking 2,000 doors, I fully engaged my party and pulled over plenty of help. So in 2018, what we found is we have all the name ID. Ruth Ann has relied on enough straight ticket Democrat voting that she could just walk in, and she's never campaigned.
Okay.
Of all those houses I knocked, nobody had ever heard of Ruth Ann Gaines outside of maybe 12 people, and half of them were former students, and they had no idea she was their representative.
Okay.
So with our name ID, with us being right on the issues, and people actually having to check the candidate and not check the party this year, we're looking really good. I really feel good about how we're looking.
Okay. So how many doors have you knocked on so far?
This year we're letting people rest from the primaries, and we are going to get started this weekend.
Okay. All right. So just getting started, but you got a head start compared to 2016. So,
absolutely.
Looking at Trump's ability to draw in working class voters, and that was obvious that, you know, looking at Rust Belt states that happened, and even true right here in Iowa. What are some key issues that you are focusing on that you're planning on focusing on when you're going out to knock on doors?
Sure. One thing for me is, you're referencing Trump. We can talk about how the economy, how we see that we're doing better when you lower people's taxes and leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody currently right now feels, hey, we are starting to do just a little bit better. Now, the tax cuts weren't anything what they should have been, but you start from here and you look, and then we look back to the Reagan Revolution. And before him, we look back to Calvin Coolidge, and we see, hey, every time the government gets smaller, taxes less, and gets the heck out of people's lives, mm-hmm. we prosper. And I can make that case. Some of the more local issues, the schools these days, why a person can't decide that, hey, this school here is the best school for my child to attend, I'm going to take him there. Why they can't make that decision because the government steps in and says, no, you'll educate them the way I say, mm-hmm. is absolutely astonishing to me.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You're based entirely in Des Moines public school system, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Des Moines is one of three districts, I believe, in the state of Iowa that can curtail any open enrollment. Used to be based on race. Now it's based on socioeconomic. You have, whether you qualify for basically free or reduced lunches or not. If you do qualify, then they can release you out of the district. If you don't, they can hold you. Should you be elected, is that something that you work to change?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. The idea that the government gets in and tells us where and how we can educate our children, is such an egregious overstep. I would definitely bang the pots and pans on that one. And while we're on the school,
mm-hmm.
This idea that our kids are going into these schools and we've got a sign out front that says gun-free zone. We all know common sense and the statistics from the FBI themselves. You hang that sign in the front, what you've told somebody who is willing to commit murder is all the good people are disarmed here for you.
Okay.
And the idea that we put an armed police officer in the school, well, we don't make it safer by putting more guns in there is the argument I hear.
Right.
Well, when we made our airports safer, did we say, no, don't put more guns in the airports? That's a completely unreasonable argument. It's not even an argument. It's just partisanship spitwatting.
Right. Well, Des Moines has actually school resource officers. Yep. Would you support putting more in, or what would school safety look like for you? Ideally, what do you think Des Moines public schools should do?
Ideally, I would like the sheriff and the police department to have more leeway on deciding what we need to do to secure these buildings. When we secure our president or we secure our airports, we have the experts say, okay, here's what security looks like, and here's why, and here's data, and here's our plan. We don't need a politician deciding those choices, but we see far too often that there's a very large school with one SRO who may not be effective in that situation. So I would definitely, I think we all want to know that, hey, mm-hmm. we can send our child to the school that's going to best educate our child, and we don't have to worry about something horrific happening.
Right. Well, I know
every person wants that.
Right. I know some people will point to like what happened in Texas, for instance. There was a school resource officer there, but he was unable to prevent, you know, a loss of life. But however, a lot of people don't realize. I mean, I went to Hoover. I graduated from Hoover in 1990, and we had roughly under 2,000 students at the time I graduated. I had a graduating class of 220, so probably a little bit more than, probably less than 1,500 students, actually, not 2,000. But that's a big building, multiple entrances. You know how many school resource officers we had?
How many did you have then?
One.
Yeah.
One to cover all these, you know. So the thought that just one would do the trick, especially when you have multiple entrances, I'm thinking what a lot of schools need to consider is what, you know, we do with a lot of other government buildings, restricted access to certain entrances, and have, you know, one or two guarded entrances. And that would probably prevent a lot of, you know, a lot of these things from taking place. But anyway, while we're talking about school, and you've expressed, you would support repealing the open enrollment restriction on certain mainly urban districts. Do you support school choice? What would that look like for you?
You know, school choice. I like the voucher program. I like things that I've seen there.
Okay.
So the tax dollars can follow the student.
Okay. You're probably thinking more education savings grants than a voucher. Voucher goes directly from state to school, where a education savings account or education savings grant would follow the child. So you're thinking more.
Yeah, that's one form I've heard is a voucher that,
okay,
you know, can follow the child, could be used in private school. And I know the governor signed legislation making the 529 more flexible, which is a great step.
Right, right. Okay. Now, in your view, do you support local control in education? And what would that look like, ideally?
Yeah, you know, the more local we can make anything the government does, the more responsive and the more tailored fit to the individual communities it's going to be. You know, obviously you go to a different school district and one's going to be more rural than the other. One's going to be a little more urban. You know, you can tailor make the schools to fit those students better. Overall, anything that you can do to make it more local by the government, is better. Because you see how it affects you and your neighborhood, and you can go directly to the person, the school board, and you can tell them exactly what you think and what you feel. And that's why on all my campaign literature, my personal cell phone number is on there.
Okay.
My personal email is on there. We should be talking to our local leaders and representatives more than we're concerned about what's going on in Washington, because Washington can't tailor fit a school for Iowa that also works in Hawaii and works in Alaska and works in New York. The Federal Department of Education was put in by Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And every year since then, we've spent more money on schools and we've lost our standing on education performance within the world. So why in the world do we keep thinking we shouldn't be breaking this down to the local level?
Yeah, people think centralizing is the answer. So you would support, say, the repeal of Common Core state standards?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, yes. Awesome. You already touched on kind of expressed your position on life. So I want to move on to you mentioned your dissatisfaction with the current tax reform bill that was passed. It doesn't go far enough. Ideally, where would you like to see that go?
Well, you know, the problem is when we discuss tax reform, we get the commercial of, you know, Paul Ryan's trying to push grandma off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not having an intelligent discussion. If somebody is saying things like that, they are trying to whip you up into a frenzy and make you not think and sit down and talk logically. You know, we have the Laffer curve we can look at. We have from history, like I said, we go back to Reagan, we go back to Coolidge, and even today with the slight tax cuts, we see that you do better when the government steals less of your money out of mm-hmm. your paycheck and you decide what to do with it. And where we're sitting now, we're still the most benevolent country in the world. Right. Even after they've ripped us off from our paycheck, we still give and give and give and take care of our fellow man. You don't get that from the government. So I guess, you know, I don't think that my issue with the current tax cuts was we didn't give the people enough of their own money back. You know, we did some things that allowed corporations to expand and hire more people. And as a result, we've seen that our unemployment numbers are coming to, you know, as low as they've been in decades.
Okay. Are you talking more the federal or the state tax reform?
I was speaking at the federal level.
Okay.
Initially.
Right. Okay.
But yes, the state plan, you know, it's more of the same. We let you keep more of your money and let you do it. Let you be an entrepreneur, let you build a business, or let you decide to invest it in your children's future.
Right.
People will handle their money better than some bureaucrat who has removed it from your paycheck.
Now, I definitely think the tax reform for the corporate tax reform, probably, you know, definitely dropping that top rate down by 3% is extremely helpful and will make mm-hmm. Iowa more competitive with corporate tax, income tax rate structure.
We're really hurting as a state.
Right.
Our tax rate.
We're right. I mean, it was the highest in the nation. It was, inconceivable that we would have, you know, that, you know, some people think that's okay. And how they think we're actually going to be competitive with our neighbors when we have such a high corporate income tax rate. And I still think even after the reform, it's better, but it's still not real competitive yet. However, looking at the personal income tax, at least initially, we're not talking much of a change at the top rate. And even overall, I mean, we're not even like we're looking at probably about a half of a percent of a cut. Of course, keeping federal deductibility for right now. So basically what this particular cut's doing is making sure that our taxes aren't, our state taxes, income taxes aren't raised because of federal deductibility, because of the federal income tax being cut, which
right.
is,
and it's good that they got that done.
Yeah, it's good they got that done. We need, you know, otherwise we're going to see our tax, our state income tax go up. So that's good.
Right.
However, I'm concerned about the income tax the revenue trigger that they passed along with this, because we're supposed to reach $8.3 billion before they draw, before we're see, you're going to see the actual, I think the significant changes with income tax reform and here in the state of Iowa, and that's dropping our tax brackets from 9 to 4, and we're going to see a more significant cut down to 6.5% being the top rate instead of, I think it's going to be 8.23 right now initially. And then of course at that point, then federal deductibility would be eliminated, but this is going to be basically this amounts to about a 4% revenue increase each fiscal year up to 2023, when we're supposed to hit $8.3 billion in revenue. We've never been right on that pace. So I'm right thinking, is this ever going to happen? And you know, if elected, how would you work to address that?
Well, on the principle of a revenue trigger, I'm not opposed to that. And in some instances, that may be a very good idea, but pretty much everybody agrees we haven't lowered our tax rate enough to have enough of a business boom to ever reach that trigger. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all pretty much agree. Yeah, what's the point? but like I said, at least we got something done in response to the federal tax cuts, so we didn't get ourselves further dug in a hole. But we need to not just be avoiding digging further in the hole, we need to be advancing. We absolutely have to be competitive with at least the states surrounding us. And you look at all the businesses, all the high-tech businesses we have here in Iowa. You know, everybody thinks we're just, everybody from out of state, you know, they think we're just driving around tractors and having school in the middle of a cornfield. And we have really, really high-tech advanced businesses in our state. I mean, look at me back in the 90s. Here I am working in a department where we're making microchips, mm-hmm. you know, and there was a cornfield on the outside. But, you know, my point is Iowa is a beautiful state. People love to come here despite the fact that we're not competitive with our business taxes. And imagine how much growth we would hit if we were. I mean, a 4% growth, if we really get off the backs of citizens and the businesses and let them grow, we definitely could hit 4%. But I don't think we're to that point yet.
Right. The Supreme Court just passed last week, or the not passed, excuse me, they decided.
That's essentially what happened.
Well, yeah, I know. They vote instead of decide. The Supreme Court decided in favor of, in Wayfair v. South Dakota, basically saying states can require out-of-state internet retailers, online retailers, to collect sales tax from in-state consumers, if that makes sense. So, yeah. Which, you know, I can kind of see South Dakota's passed a law stating that companies, I think the threshold was you had to have 100,000 worth of sales and 200 customers, something like that, before their sales tax triggered. But, you know, they don't have an income tax and they're dependent on sales tax. So I can kind of see their point, but I'm thinking, you know, I was probably going to be following this example. How would you handle, you know, internet sales tax if it were to come up? I mean, I believe the tax reform package already allows sales tax for online retailers within the state, but I don't think it impacts outside the state. So how would you handle that as a representative if you're elected?
Yeah, you know, and I like the idea that South Dakota said, hey, here's our situation, because as a sovereign state, we decided we don't want an income tax, and here's how it affects us. And they decided for themselves, through their elected state legislature, that we want to do this. And I think that's fine. What I don't like is that it had to go to the federal government and have what's basically become our 9-person pullet bureau on the Supreme Court.
Right.
That, yes, as your overlords, I will allow you to make that law. You know, the federal government shouldn't even be involved.
Well, actually, there was already, in the Supreme Court's defense, you don't see me defending them that often, there was already precedent that didn't allow states to do that. So that needed to be addressed. Yeah. So on one hand, it's like, yay for federalism. Right. But on the other hand, oh, wow. Now we get this could end up being a problem for, especially for small online retailers. I'm not so concerned about Amazon and Wayfair and Overstock.com because they're huge and they could probably absorb that. Okay. But some of your smaller retailers could end up feeling the pinch on this.
Yeah. So, you know, it becomes for, you know, you're referencing smaller retailers, that just becomes another regulation, another burden, another expense that they have to go through. And we've been buying and selling on the internet for decades now. And what we've seen is most of your brick and mortar stores, especially your small ones, they also sell online. They also utilize eBay and Amazon, and they're really able to expand their sales. Mm-hmm. And so now we're starting to inch in where, you know, we know what they want to do. They want to find another way to tax us and take more of our money. You know, that's the trajectory they're on. And I'm very much against that. Mm-hmm. You know, leave these stores alone.
Yeah.
If they choose not to sell on the internet, then they know that they're going to have to charge their customers a state sales tax in the brick and mortar store. But we've seen everybody adapt and everybody get along just fine. And it's just an issue where the government basically needs to stay out.
Right. Right. Okay. Just a quick question before because we're already at like 26 minutes here. Are there any other issues that we haven't discussed that, you know, you want to talk about? I want to make sure that you get to promote your platform here before I let you go.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the traffic cameras has been a big part of what I'm running on. I know they're turning them back on. Well, they turned them back on today, actually, on I-235. And we can talk about the Fourth Amendment issue, which is huge. Mm-hmm. But we can get even more basic and even more common sense than that. You know, when they turned them off on I-380 there between Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, what they saw was the speed went up and the amount of accidents went down. So the road's safer by not bypassing somebody's Fourth Amendment right and sending them a ticket in the mail.
Right.
Now, I heard on another program, the Des Moines Police Department, which is kind of running these cameras, they said they're turning them back on. And the representative said, well, I know that the DOT has data on what's happened since we've had the cameras off, but I don't know what it is.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you're telling me you're going to do something to our roadways, mm-hmm. and you're not going to bother to look and see if it's going to have a negative effect on safety.
Right.
I was just appalled.
This is, it's obviously never been about safety. It's always been about revenue.
Right.
So,
which is my guess, is he has seen the numbers and he doesn't want to talk about them.
Okay, now here a Democrat will say, well, wait a minute, you support local control, right? Why don't you support mm-hmm. cities and counties being able to do that?
Right, and you know, we saw in Clive when they passed it, they booted every one of those councilmen out that had voted for him. So there was a great example of the local government working. But if we're going to put these traffic cameras up and we're not even going to look at whether it's safer or not,
mm-hmm.
there's something wrong, you know, in that locality that's making that decision. But on a more general level, we all know your Fourth Amendment rights have been completely trampled on.
Right.
And I would stand against it just on that fact. But if we can also point out, hey, we're less safe because they're trampling on your Fourth Amendment, we should be able as politicians to make the case that these need to go.
Okay. Well, hey, where can people learn more about your campaign?
Sure. My website is, and I'll, it's my name .win.gop. So it's BILLCHARLIER.win.gop.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate it, and best of luck to you in November.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. Glad to be on.
Hey, take care.
All right. You too.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's caffeinated, CAFFEINATED, caffeinatedthoughts.com, or Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our email so you don't miss a single article. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and we'd appreciate a 5-star rating. You can also listen on Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. Until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.